In their book Nurture Shock, Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman discuss a study in which kids were read The Boy Who Cried Wolf or the story about George Washington and the cherry tree. You know, the possibly tall tale in which Washington's father asks young George about the fallen cherry tree, and he responds, "I cannot tell a lie. I did cut it with my hatchet." The question is, which story would be better at decreasing lying by the children? So, can you guess the results? So here they are. Hearing the George Washington story led to a 75% reduction in lying by the boys and a 50% reduction in lying by the girls, with the theory being that the children heard about young George being rewarded for telling the truth. So how about The Boy Who Cried Wolf? Hearing that story actually led to an increase in lying by the children. Why? The theory is that the story teaches kids that lies are punished. Therefore, when caught in initial lies, the children double down on their deceit to avoid punishment. Of course, when a parent or a teacher catches a kid in a lie that conflicts with objective facts, this type of doubling down is likely to result in sharper rebuke. But when the police catch a kid in a lie, sometimes they'll help him massage his story to fit with reality. And sometimes, that leads to scrapping the first draft and crafting an entirely new narrative. This is exactly what happened with Travis Slaughter, and it's why Wayne Brady and Carl Willis are still in prison for the murder of Maurice Purify, and Travis Slaughter is not.
Welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Carl Willis and Wayne Brady. This is the third episode in a four-episode series about Carl Willis and Wayne Brady, who were convicted of the 1998 murder of 13-year-old Maurice Purify in Toledo, Ohio. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Last week, we took you through the 6.5-hour interrogation of 18-year-old Travis Slaughter on August 27, 1998. After initially denying involvement in the murder of 13-year-old Maurice Purify in Toledo, Ohio, Travis told the following story with heavy assistance from the Toledo police. He was walking with Wayne Brady and Carl Willis when they came upon Maurice Purify. Maurice owed Carl a drug debt, so Carl and Wayne beat him up, with Carl firing a single fatal gunshot to Maurice's head. Now, last episode, we made the claim that this was a false confession, but we aren't the first ones to make this claim. Instead, it was a claim made by Travis Slaughter himself. After Travis confessed, his attorney retained the services of clinical psychologist Wayne J. Graves, PhD. Dr. Graves watched Travis's 6.5-hour interrogation and met with him for 2 hours on January 2, 1999. He then issued a report on Travis, starting with the following background information.
He has a reading level at the beginning fifth grade level based on a screening use of the Wide Range Achievement Test. This level is generally viewed as adequate to read Miranda warnings. He appears to have an adequate but very elementary understanding of the meaning of the Miranda warning. He does reveal that he was academically in special classes through much of his childhood. And specifically, from 4th through 9th grade, he was in DH, developmentally handicapped classes. This would suggest a borderline IQ or lower functioning. The operational definition for inclusion in developmental handicapped classes includes significantly sub-average general intellectual functioning existing concurrently with deficits in adaptive behavior manifested during the developmental period, which adversely affects a child's educational performance. The rule's extended definition to include the range down from borderline through mild mental retardation, that is, an IQ of 80 or below.
Dr. Graves then begins his analysis of Travis's police interrogation by noting the following.
Travis asserts at this point that the statement given to the police was false and that he did not know the victim and ended up essentially making up the story in order to end the interrogation. He tells me that he produced this false statement because he was frightened, gradually more and more convinced that he was going to lose his freedom and his ability to convince anyone of his innocence. He felt as if he would die by suicide anyway, shortly after, or if found guilty of this offense. He made active threats throughout the interrogation.
Now, we can't confirm that Travis made up his story about the murder of Maurice Purify, but we can confirm that he made comments about committing suicide throughout the police interrogation. Here's one example.
That's why I want to take a lying check. Like I said, I refuse to go to jail. If I went for it, they could put me on suicide watch or anything. If that won't stop me, I'll hold my fucking breath till I pass out.
And here's another.
They helped me out, got me in the right path.
Okay. Don't want to die, right?
Not really, but...
You just gotta deal with these things as a man. You're a man now. You can't run away from things. You have to deal with them.
But I refuse to go back to jail. I'll kill myself. I'll get locked up again. I know it's a sin to kill yourself, but right about now, I don't give a fuck.
Mostly, the Toledo police respond to these suicide threats by claiming that Travis is lying, just like he's lying about Maurice's murder.
Well, which one of your friends are you concerned about?
Actually, my family, my brothers, cousins, people who helped me out throughout my life when I ain't had none. I got friends out on the street who used to look out for me with my moms and put me up. Outside the house, and I'd have been outside in winter, summer, and I'm just thinking about how they gonna feel if I did want to kill myself and refuse to do some time. I mean, would they come to my funeral?
Travis, let's just be honest. With these statements you're making,
I'm being honest.
You concerned about how they gonna feel about you telling the truth opposed to you killing yourself. You don't want to kill yourself, and you know that.
Yes, I do.
No, you don't.
Why? Because what you did to this boy?
No. Because I refuse to go back to the system. I'd have told people before all this happened. I said, I'll kill myself. I'll go back to jail. And they told me, like, you talking crazy. You need help.
But the officers never respond to Travis's statements by offering him help. Instead, they plow forward with a cycle of interrogation and accusation. Dr. Graves describes this in his report as follows. He says he was responding to the ongoing continuous assertions by the detectives, as he heard it, that they knew he did it. And at some point, he decided, quote, they'd never leave me alone unless I say I did something. After he made a statement, he remembers being complimented on doing a good job. You did the right thing, he was told, after he produced some information that seemed to satisfy them. One of the threats which he says was, quote, too much, was when there was some threat to get a brother or family member involved. Quote, so I began to make up a statement to go along with them to show them that he was innocent and did nothing, even if he was there. Most of the ideas that he presented had been details given to him by his mother about what had happened to the victim, based on an article in the paper that she had talked about and been upset about, and had posted on the front of the refrigerator. He described his mother as very emotional about the attack. Travis's recollection lines up with the recording of his interrogation. For example, after hours of calling Travis a liar and browbeating him, here's how the officer responds when he finally admits to seeing a masked man commit the murder.
This stuff, we could be done with this today. You can start getting your rest, your sleep. You can feel good about yourself because you came clean about it.
There won't be nothing to feel good about.
Yeah, there will. For once you did the right thing. For once in your life, you owed up to something you'd done and did the right thing. That's something to feel good about. Don't ever give that up. Don't ever give up on yourself like that.
Man, and I'm a lot older than you are, man, and I'm gonna tell you this, man. The truth works. The truth works. When you lie and continue lying, whole shit in your system, man, it eats you inside out, believe me.
It's a slow death. It's what?
You lay there at night, your eyes buck wide, your stomach acting crazy.
But that's because you have a conscience. And that displays more than a lot of people have. A lot of people don't even bother them. But I believe it bothers you. Because you're more of a man. More of a man has a conscience.
So you can hear the officers both praising Travis, but also telling him that there must have been more, that he needs to clear his conscience and admit his involvement. In his report, Dr. Graves writes the following. His first attempt at producing a statement for the detectives did not satisfy them when he first said that he had heard the shots and simply saw the body. So he later began to add details, making them up based on details he simply generated in his mind. He does acknowledge that he had told his girlfriend, Chandra, afterwards that he had seen the boy get shot, but then asserts that he told her that he had actually not and was simply kidding with her, something he did in order to feel bigger.
Travis's claim that he added details that he generated in his own mind lines up with what we noted last episode, which that some pretty key details of his story don't line up with objective facts, like the clothes that Maurice was wearing, the caliber of the gun used to shoot him, and Wayne and Carl dragging Maurice's body. So does it make sense that Travis would do this? In his report, Dr. Graves observes that the police detective's interrogation was conducted in a very small room, with videotape camera aimed at the defendant, but without the ability to see the face of two or three interrogators who come in and out of the room. The interrogation took place over about a 6-hour time period, and was, in my opinion, psychologically coercive, deceptive, and manipulative. The interrogators feigned concern and sympathy, appealed to God and religion after they observed Travis praying when he was alone in the room. They made use of informant information that may or may not have been true. They appeared to use false assertions, used scare tactics, offered sympathy, tried face-saving excuses, engaged in minimization, and gave implied threats. This was done by making assertions such as, "Let us know before things get out of hand. You gotta ask for forgiveness to start the healing." They pushed his belief in God and his need for confession. They implied concern and condemnation by his mother, asking about whether he was concerned regarding his mother, thus pushing him not to let her down, appealing to his concern for his mother. Much of this can be heard in one portion of the police interrogation, when Lieutenant Ross implores Travis not to go to the grave with this in his conscience. Travis responds by asking, "Isn't it a sin to kill or something?" And here's a portion of Lieutenant Ross's response.
"None of us are perfect in this world. I'm not perfect, you're not perfect. It could be easily changed. You could be the officer over here, and I could be sitting over there. And you'd want the truth out of me to start the healing process. And that's where I would start."
"If I was an officer and you was me, first thing I'd ask is, since you ain't do it, prove to me that you ain't do it. And if you can prove that you ain't do it, I'll do it."
"That's not how I do it. You always start with the truth. You're in denial, and you've got to get over that. It's going to weigh you down something fierce. Look at your mom. You want to be able to look at everyone. You want to be able to look at your brothers and sisters and your friends and say, hey, I'm a man. I got over this. I beat this. Because nothing but bad can come out of the rest of your life if you don't get over this here and now."
But the main thing that the Toledo police did was to continually push back on Travis when he denied having anything to do with Maurice's murder. At least 25 times, Travis denied involvement, and every time the police would claim that he couldn't be telling the truth. As Dr. Graves noted in his report, They engaged in a continuous rejection of his statements. They did not match what was requested. They kept a continuous repetition of "speak the truth." They asserted their knowledge as if it were fact. "You killed him. There's no doubt about it." Anything that he said which did not go in the direction they wanted, they rejected in some fashion by statements like, "We don't accept that. That's not true." At some point about 4 hours into the interrogation, they began to give him alternatives. If you didn't do it, you gotta prove you didn't do it, which began to imply they might at some point eventually believe him if he provided evidence that he was not the actual perpetrator. Since they would not accept that he was not there, they left no alternative but for him to escape the interrogation by producing some statement that he was there. They pushed cleansing of the soul, to get that terrible thing out of your life. They asserted that others were doing this out of concern for him. Somebody put this on out of concern for you. When he confessed to having made a deal with the devil at age 12 after he had done something in order to have a better life, they began to use this deal with the devil in connection with his religious belief. So in terms of this deal with the devil at age 12, that involved Travis playing with a Ouija board as a teen and passing out after he asked the devil to give him a better life. Travis shares with the officers that he's felt cursed for the rest of his life, and they respond by playing into this burden that he feels.
"I believe this terrible weight, this terrible thing that's happened to you all your life has been with you since that day at the Ouija board, and you don't know how to get rid of it. And we don't want to throw the towel in on you, man. I can't be more sincere than what I'm telling you right now. Otherwise, we'd have walked out here, we'd have walked away hours ago. How can we help you if you won't help yourself?"
"I try to help myself every time I'm in trouble."
This then takes us to Dr. Graves' final conclusion in his report, in which he writes the following. "It is my professional opinion that Mr. Slaughter is intellectually limited and psychologically vulnerable. He had a limited ability to remember and understand the Miranda warning, or to see it as a functional alternative during the interrogation process. I believe he was coerced psychologically during the interrogation process, and his vulnerabilities taken advantage of. His confession lacked voluntariness and has the hallmarks of a coerced, compliant false confession from a vulnerable suspect, as defined by Kasson, 1997. While the interrogation itself did not have physically coercive elements, what was perhaps legally allowable did not adequately permit the exercise of free will or freedom of choice. Voluntariness was really not available to him. His coerced, self-incriminating statement made after police use of manipulation, deception, and trickery has a strong likelihood of being insufficiently discounted regarding its validity by a jury, because most research suggests that juries do not adequately understand the nature and conditions under which confessions of this type take place."
And so, based on Dr. Graves' report, Travis moved to suppress his statement. That motion was reviewed by Judge James Jensen, who issued a ruling on March 8, 1999. Judge Jensen began by observing that the prosecution has the burden of proving that a suspect's confession was voluntary, and that a confession is voluntary only if it is, quote, the product of an essentially free and unconstrained choice by its maker. Based on this standard, it might have seemed like Travis had a winning argument. After all, Dr. Graves literally concluded that Travis's confession lacked voluntariness and that the coercive interrogation techniques did not permit the exercise of free will or freedom of choice. But with criminal procedure, things are rarely ever that simple. Recall how Dr. Graves concluded that Travis had an IQ of 80 or below and thus, quote, an adequate but very elementary understanding of the meaning of the Miranda warning, and also that, quote, he had a limited ability to remember and understand the Miranda warning or to see it as a functional alternative during the interrogation process. According to Judge Jensen, this rudimentary understanding of Miranda was sufficient.
And what about the fact that Travis was questioned for 6.5 hours in a small room? Judge Jensen noted that this was no biggie because Travis was allowed to take breaks, without acknowledging the fact that Travis used those breaks to express suicidal thoughts and anguished prayers to God. And about those prayers, Judge Jensen acknowledged that the officers had preyed upon Travis's religious beliefs, but concluded that, quote, These appeals to defendant's conscience were not so outrageous as to render his statements involuntary. Therefore, Judge Jensen denied Travis's motion to suppress his statement, not once mentioning how people age 18 and under are much likelier to give false confessions than adults. And with that, Travis started working with the state to secure convictions for Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy in connection with the murder of Maurice Purify. On April 20th, 1999, he gave a statement to police in which he said that Carl, Wayne, and he had a plan to lure Maurice onto a porch so they could kill him. But then, in a subsequent statement a week later, on April 27th, 1999, he denied any such porch plan. Instead, Travis claimed they had randomly come across Maurice, with Carl spotting him from a distance. But there was a problem with this claim. We'll be citing WTOL's coverage of this case in this episode, and here's a clip of Carl Willis's interview with WTOL's Brian Duggar.
They said that you saw something, right? And there was something with your eyesight, that you had like bad eyesight.
Yes. I didn't wear glasses back then.
Okay.
They said that I was the one that spotted Maurice Purified. Travis said this.
At like 3 in the morning.
Yes.
In the dark.
Yes. Now, if I take off my glasses, I can barely see you. So, if I didn't have glasses, I didn't wear glasses then because I didn't think glasses was cool. So, I was still growing into the person I am today. So, I didn't wear glasses because I thought I looked funny in them. So, it's impossible for me to see anybody from a distance without my glasses on.
You might also recall that Travis's initial story involved Carl taking out his gun and shooting Maurice once in the head. Well, by Travis's own admission, his story changed after the police showed him the crime scene photos. Maurice, of course, was shot 5 times. So now, Travis says that it was his gun and there was a bit of hot potato going on. First, he shot Maurice. Then, he handed the gun to Carl so Carl could shoot Maurice. And then, Carl handed the gun to Wayne so he could also shoot Maurice. Oh, and about that gun? You might remember that Travis said it was a .380 during his police interrogation. Now he claims it was a .25, which conveniently matches the shell casings found at the crime scene. So, what happened to the gun? Travis claims that Carl took it, although he later changes his story to say that he stored it in the garage where he used to live. When asked about this change in his story at trial, Travis says it was one of his false statements, an admission he makes many times at trial. In other words, you can see why the first grand jury did not indict Carl and Wayne based on Travis's claims. But in July of 1999, Travis pled out to manslaughter and related charges in connection with the death of Maurice Purify, as well as to statutory rape based on the incident we mentioned last episode. Under the agreement, the sentences for the crimes ran concurrently, meaning at the same time, so for a total of 18 years. And so, in 2016, Travis was released from incarceration. Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy haven't been so lucky. The prosecution used Travis's claims and Chandrea Rayford's corroboration to get an indictment against them at a second grand jury, and they were arrested shortly thereafter. Here's Wayne Braddy's recollections about being arrested.
Well, for a long time, they wasn't telling me what was going on. I didn't have no idea why they even had me. So what's going through my mind is just a slight sense of bewilderment, just, you know, unknown, just curiosity. But it's not something that was not unfamiliar to me because being in the inner city, I done been picked up by police plenty of times just for being out, you know what I mean? Like I say, and then some of them know me, but the ones from the community, you know, I know them personally. So when it comes to the detectives, I don't know them. When they come, it's a whole different feeling because you don't know how that could turn out, you know what I mean? And thankfully, I'm still here because It's been some times that some detectives done hopped out on me and, you know, they done threatened to blow me away. And that's I don't know how to describe that feeling.
Meanwhile, here's Carl Willis remembering being arrested and brought in for questioning.
So when they said, we know you have something to do with this case. I said, no, I do not have nothing to do with this case. Whatsoever, I don't have no knowledge of this case. I don't know what happened with this case. I don't know what you're talking about. But they said, Travis said you did this and Wayne said you did that. I said, well, they lying. So they took me into a room and they had a TV in there with a VCR. They put the VCR on and they showed Travis making a confession and acting a damn fool, talking about me, him, and Wayne committed this murder. You know, I dragged him by a tree, this and that. I'm like, hold on. And he's my bitch coming from a house party of a lady named Tanky. And I'm like, I know Tanky, but I've never been to her house. So they cut the videotape off and told me, you lying. I said, if you think I'm lying, I'm willing to take a polygraph test right now. And they're like, well, we'll look into that, but right now, you need to confess and tell me everything that happened.
Now, in case you're wondering, no, Wayne did not flip on Carl, a fact that Carl was soon able to confirm.
Because before we even left Scott Park Station, they put me and Wayne in the same room together. And I asked Wayne what was going on. He said, I don't know, Travis on some bullshit. I said, Wayne, I don't know what's going on. I don't have no clue what's going on. If you know anything, you need to let me know now. Wayne said, Bub, because that's my nickname. He said, I promise you, Travis on some bullshit. I don't have nothing to do with this case. I don't have no knowledge of this case.
And so, in the moment, Carl thought that he'd be going home.
I'm thinking of this like, they about to let us go. Because I know damn well that I wasn't with Wayne, and I know I wasn't with Travis. So I'm like, I'm on home.
But Carl wasn't going home, and neither was Wayne. Instead, they were on a beeline for a joint trial in January 2000 on charges connected to the murder of Maurice Purify. And at that trial, they heard Travis's new narrative. You'll recall that Travis initially claimed they killed Maurice because he owed Carl money. Well, at trial, Travis now claims that Maurice owed him money. According to Travis, he gave Maurice $800 worth of marijuana to sell in early June 1999. When Maurice hadn't paid him his cut a couple of weeks later, he got pissed off and roughed him up. Travis then told Carl and Wayne about his troubles and offered to pay them $200 to lay out Maurice, in other words, to murder him. Travis claimed that they agreed, but also claimed that on June 14th, they didn't set out to murder Maurice. Instead, Travis says that Wayne, Carl, and he started hanging out at about 11 a.m., got drunk and high, and then just started roaming the streets aimlessly before they happened to run into Maurice in the early morning hours of June 15th. That's when they played the game of musical gun, taking turns firing shots at Maurice. Finally, Travis took off Maurice's shoes and emptied his pockets, finding $85, which he didn't share with Carl or Wayne. Oh, and he also says he didn't pay them the promised $200. And when asked why Travis needed Carl and Wayne when he had a gun and had already roughed up the 13-year-old Maurice without issue, he doesn't really have a response. Wayne Brady distinctly remembers what it was like to hear Travis testify at trial.
I just kept shaking my head. And it was like something that, it was like, if I could describe it best, it was like, you know, if you ever had like a ringing in your ear and it take a while to go away, hearing him talk was like, it was like just a ringing in my ear. And I was like, man, it's disturbing me. Like, what is this? And none of it seemed like it's really happening. You know what I mean? It's like a, I don't know what's the word for it. You know what I mean?
Meanwhile, Carl Willis is reflected in the absurdity of the twin propositions that he would kill a 13-year-old and that he would kill him for $200.
Coming from the area and the culture I come from, who in their right mind would go hurt a 13-year-old child? You gotta have a motive. You gotta have some kind of connection. You gotta have some kind of demon, demonic spirit in you to want to go hurt a child. I have nephews and nieces that was at the age. And if someone hurt my nephews and nieces, I know I'd be upset. So why would I go hurt somebody else's child or nephew?
Any of your nephews and nieces know Maurice?
No.
Or are they from different areas?
They're from different areas.
Mm. But Travis said you had a motive because he paid you $200, right?
$200? $200 to go commit a murder. $200 won't allow you to get an attorney. I knew that from back then.
And then he said he didn't even give you the $200. And he took $79 from Maurice's pocket and refused to give you any of that. Right?
That's what the records state.
That makes sense to you?
I don't think it made sense to nobody. I don't think nobody in America made sense to.
To me, it seemed like coming from the culture you come from, you're going to kill a 13-year-old kid. Someone says they're going to give you money. They don't give you any money. Seemed like you'd be really mad about that, and you probably wouldn't let him walk away. All right?
You said it.
So it still doesn't make any sense to you.
What possibly can $200 do? $200 is, even though back then, considering the age, it's a piece of money, but $200 to go commit a crime?
To kill a 13-year-old.
What possibly can even a 13-year-old be involved with that you want to do something to him for $200? That's a child.
So to Carl's point, was the jury believing Travis? Here's jury foreman John Cry.
Yeah, so, I mean, we had no doubts that he definitely wasn't a good guy, but we assumed that all three of them were. You know, without having any background on the other two, there was a lot of assumption there that, like, hey, these, you know, all three of these guys have been involved in stuff, and it's not just one guy that might be a liar. It's a whole bunch of people that could be liars. So we knew that what was brought into question was like, okay, not necessarily is this guy a liar, because even on the stand he was kind of shaky, and some of the things he said was kind of shaky. It was, is he lying about this?
And when John Cry is saying that Travis was shaky on the witness stand, he doesn't know the half of it. As we've noted, Travis's story fundamentally changed from the one he told in his police interrogation to the one he relayed at trial. For example, in his interrogation, Travis said that Maurice had been wearing a red t-shirt and black shorts. At trial, however, Travis testified that Maurice was wearing black pants and a black and beige checkered flannel shirt over a white t-shirt. Unsurprisingly, this matches what Maurice was wearing, and Travis testifies about Maurice's clothing that, quote, "I could never forget something like that." But of course, Travis did forget this fact in his police interrogation. Or, if he gave a false confession, he never knew this fact until the police showed him the crime scene photos. Unfortunately, defense counsel never questioned Travis at trial about this or many other changes in his story. Moreover, the defense only called one witness at trial, Jeffrey Helmick, a criminal defense attorney, who testified about how Travis's plea deal supplied him with an incentive to lie. In total, Wayne and Carl's trial lasted just about 10 hours, with the only witnesses being 1, Travis Slaughter, 2, Jeffrey Helmick, and 3, government witnesses who testified that the evidence conflicted with Travis's claims about Carl and Wayne dragging Maurice to a tree, and that none of the evidence tested in the case linked Carl and Wayne to the crime. And then, of course, there was Chandrea Rayford, whose aborted testimony was supposed to be ignored by the jury. As we heard last episode, though, the jury did give Chandrea's testimony strong consideration. And there was something else that had a big impact on jury foreman John Cry.
You know, the fact that this was a 13-year-old kid came into play. Like, they brought his clothes in and laid them out on the table in front of the jury. I mean, you could see it was a little kid that was killed. So, like I said, we were deciding, like, are we going to, is there enough there? You know, I know it's innocent until proven guilty, but, you know, we were potentially letting off two guys that killed a 13-year-old. The clothes is what really sticks out to me. I was bringing the clothes in there in the bag and just and leaving them out there. Like, that's the one thing that sticks out to me the most.
Now, notably, this isn't evidence that Wayne or Carl killed Maurice, and so you can imagine that jury deliberations were not easy. According to John Cry, the jury was initially split, two believing they were guilty, two believing they were innocent, and eight falling somewhere in between. After 18 hours of deliberations, in other words, 8 hours longer than the actual trial, the jury came back, but not with a verdict.
And even the jury itself, like, you know, like you mentioned, when they asked, could they, and it was after 18 hours, if I remember correctly, they asked, you know, if they could go home, because they said, we cannot come together and reach a unanimous decision. And they was told, no, I'm not accepting that.
After this, as Wayne was being taken back to his jail cell, he had an outburst.
Well, it was a lot of tension between the court staff people and our family members. So I don't know if you ever was able to look at any of that footage or whatever, but they was, you know what I mean, disrespecting some of them and talking to them crazy, like even my grandfather, this is a elderly man, you know what I mean? And they saying different stuff to him, and you know, we aware of all that, so it's just like a whole lot of tension, you know what I mean? Like, it was already a lot of, you know, I wouldn't say quite say pressure, but just a certain level of energy in the air where, you know, this is not something that's, it wasn't something pleasant, you know what I mean? It wasn't a pleasant feeling for anybody.
Finally, after another 8 hours of deliberations, or 26 hours total, the jury announced that they had a verdict. Here's Wayne's recollection of what was going on right before they were told about the verdict.
So I was in a holding cell. They had me in one side, you know, and I was fenced in or whatever. And it was like another cage or whatever that they had Carl in. So he was pacing back and forth, and he had his Bible out, and he was reading his Bible, and he was talking to me. He was upset, though, and he was trying to calm himself down. And we trying to be that, just be that, you know, that calm voice in each other's mind. Like, man, listen, man, we gonna be all right, man. This ain't gonna be, you know, this is not right. We know this ain't the truth, and the truth will come out. So that's all we gotta focus on, you know what I mean?
Wayne had a clear expectation of what the verdict would be.
I had no doubt in my mind. This is my second time being in the Lucas County Jail for the same offense. I was innocent the first time. I'm still innocent.
As a result, the guilty verdict came as quite a shock to him.
Man, it was like my spirit fainted. Away from or inside my body. You know what I mean? Like, I was standing there. But it was just like my spirit just and at that time it was like a silence around me. Like, you know what I mean? Like I guess they call it like a calm before a storm, because I'm like, man, what's to happen next? Hold on. And at the same time, this ain't real. You telling me they said guilty? I'm still trying to instill that in my mind, like they said that no, they couldn't have. And all while this is going on, my family has been going back and forth with the court staff. So now they making people leave and stuff. They had kicked a few people out already. So now they outside going crazy, you know what I mean? And everybody that's in there, you know what I mean? My oldest son was just a baby. He was just learning how to walk. My cousin was holding him, I remember. And I'm looking around, I'm looking for my mother because I'm like, man, this can't be real. I'm looking for where's my mama at? You know what I mean? That's the only person who I'm looking for to bring me back, you know what I mean? Bring me back to, you know what I mean, where I need to be. Like, man, I gotta have some calm and some peace about myself because my mind is just distraught right now. So I'm looking around, where's my mama at? Where my mama? And as I'm looking at her, I'm seeing all these faces of people that I'm unfamiliar with staring at me. And I'm looking like, and it's registering in my mind like, some of these people is judging me. They really looking at me like I'm this person who was described in some of this testimony. I've never been that person, you know what I'm saying?
Meanwhile, here is Carl's recollection of his reaction to the verdict.
Honestly, when they said Carl Willis, aggravated murder, count one, guilty, I wasn't even myself. Only thing I can say is for something I didn't do. I didn't have no control of my reaction. It's not like I just intended to do that. It's just the way it came out. Because I sat there the whole trial, and I had to listen to lies being told upon me that I know I wasn't involved with. Can you put yourself in my shoes for a second? And anybody else who may see this? You sitting there at a trial, 20 years old, knowing damn well that you innocent. And you're hearing the prosecutor portraying you as a monster, as if you don't fit in society. You're hearing lies being told from you at all angles from a guy that don't even know, without him, there's nothing to even link me to this case. And you ain't do nothing but try to help this fella before. And he's sitting there just lying at you, saying you did this, then that. And you don't have no control over it. You have to just sit there and just take that abuse. I think it'd be hard for anybody to sit there and be still.
When Carl talks about not being himself after hearing the verdict and having his own outburst, he's talking about this.
Carl Willis did have firearms on his person.
It was something I didn't do!
But is this something that Carl and Wayne didn't do? One key person thinks that they're innocent, and he might be able to set them free. So who is this person? The very same person who sent them to prison more than two decades ago, Travis Slaughter.
Every time I would watch that video play, that's the Carl I knew. That's the Carl who I ran with. You know, that voice, his facial expression, his body language, the tone of his voice, you know, the emotions, the uproar, everything. I'm like, that's him, I know him. And I'm like, I just, wow. And I was like, I fucked their life up. There's him, mine. There's maybe more. You know, can't compare and weigh that. And I was just like, wow, I fucked their life up. So now, here I am reliving this lie.
Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and you can support our Patreon @UndisclosedPod.